Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Thirst Tuesday of the month, we talk gardening. Roberta Clark is not able to join us today, so sitting in for her is gardening expert C.L. Frenari. She's the author of 8 books, her latest, Sand and Soil, Creating Beautiful Gardens on the Cape and Islands. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, Mindy. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
I'm happy you're here. So we had a bit of rain over the weekend and early this morning, but I'm guessing not enough to remedy our drought situation. It has been hot and dry.
Oh, it has been terrible. It's really stressful for plants and for those of us who love plants and love the garden. My rain gauge has about a half an inch from last night, and the day before I also had about a half an inch. Better than nothing, but not good enough.
Yeah, I know you. And even when you get a rain like this, you just dig down a little bit and it is still very dry underneath. And we need what? About an inch of water a week for most plants, right?
That's right. And at this point, in order to catch up, we could use a 2-day soaker. You know,
wow.
I know
the
tourists wouldn't be happy about it, but I certainly would be dancing in my vegetable garden.
I think a lot of us would be dancing in our vegetable gardens. I guess one of the bright spots in not having and having this drought is we have fewer mosquitoes, right?
That's true. That's true. We have fewer mosquitoes and, frankly, fewer ticks. Usually you see, you know, the ticks nymphs start to come out after rains as well. So,
yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number if you have garden questions or stories or suggestions for us this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. I guess one of the other things too, when we have a season like this with not a lot of rain, it has us thinking about drought-resistant plants. And as we're looking to replace some of the things that may not make it, what are some thoughts on what, you know, like echinacea, I guess, what are some things that we could plant that would be drought-resistant?
Yeah, well, we've got a couple of native shrubs that are pretty drought-resistant. The Physocarpus group, the nine barks, those are pretty drought-resistant. And in terms of perennials, asters are very drought-resistant. Coreopsis is pretty drought-resistant. And, of course, the sedums, whether they're small, medium, or large, those all do quite well with minimum water as well. So,
yeah. And, of course, go ahead.
Well, I think, you know, one thing to sort of be thinking about, if you've been affected by, you know, plants dying and all, is to group plants according to their water needs. So, you know, you can put those junipers that don't need much water and the spireas and the Physocarpus together in one area that is mostly filled with those drought-resistant plants and keep your hydrangeas grouped someplace else.
Yeah. Speaking of hydrangeas, boy, what are, you know, you see some hydrangeas that just look like, oh, they're all brown and shriveled up, and others, it depends on how much sun they're getting with water as well. I know I was giving up on my hydrangeas and I moved them from, you know, really full sunspot to a part sun, and they do so much better where they have some of that, you know, midday shade.
That's right. It's shade in from, say, 11 o'clock in the morning through 3 o'clock that's most important for long-lasting hydrangea flowers. If they're in full sun or if they're in sun during the middle of the day, they're probably pretty browned by now, because even in well-watered soil, the plants can't pull up the water fast enough to keep those huge flowers looking fresh when they wilt every day in the hot sun.
Yeah. Now, with this heat, some of the herbs are doing really well. The tomatoes, people getting lots of great tomatoes, but people also complaining about critters eating tomatoes, all kinds of critters.
Well, you know, it's interesting because the critters basically are thirsty, right? And so you tend to see more critters going after things like the juicy tomatoes in times of drought because they're thirsty. And so those low-hanging tomatoes get partly eaten by chipmunks. The crows peck at them. So we all feel at this time of year it's a little battle. Who gets to that ripe tomato first? And I know we created a new bunny bin in our vegetable garden we always have a quarter of our home vegetable garden fenced off and plant the things that the rabbits like in there. And I call it the bunny bin. But this year, because of the rabbits being so numerous and so thirsty, we've created a second bunny bin to protect the fall crops that we just planted.
Yeah. And also, we have a rat problem we talk about quite often, and rats are another thing that get into the tomatoes. And, you know, I didn't realize how high they can actually climb, but they can pretty much get into just about anything.
That's true. It's why they're such survivors in both country and city.
Yeah. And then we also have, what is it, the what's the worm? The tomato hornworm, is that what it's called? The
yeah,
green?
That bright green. It looks like a brooch from Tiffany's. Really, they're quite striking. But they can do quite a bit of damage. So if you see whole arms of your tomatoes disappearing, you will know that you probably have the tomato hornworm. And the key to look for is what seems to be black pepper, coarse ground black pepper, on your tomato leaves right below those bare branches that have been stripped of foliage. Then you know that's what we call frass or caterpillar poop, and you look closely for that fat green tomato hornworm.
They blend in really well.
Oh, they're very hard to spot. They really are, especially as your eyes get older. But what I usually do once I find them is I put them on the bird feeder. And sometimes even, you know, the birds who routinely come to the feeder are a little grossed out by how large they are.
That's funny. I hadn't thought about putting them at the bird feeder. That's a good idea. And are we seeing problems with other insect type of damage in the garden?
Well, as always, you know, there are always populations of insects that kind of come and go. And in certain places, people might find an outbreak of whitefly or aphids on new foliage. In high summer, it's the time when we see Japanese beetles and other garden beetles around. I think one thing that people aren't as familiar with that they might be puzzling about is something that is eating the cones of their Echinacea flowers or their Rudbeckia flowers. Mm. I'm sure that Roberta has mentioned this in the past couple of years, but it's fairly new to our area and maybe the past 3 or 4 years, and it's the sunflower moth, and the moth lays its egg on the cone of our echinaceas, and the larva hatches and burrows into the cone, and the next thing you know, you look at your echinacea flower, and it looks like it's all got dark mud on it, and it's kind of distorted. And once again, that's the frass from the larva that's eating down inside the cone. And if you see it, the best thing to do is to just clip them off and throw them away so that that larva doesn't go on to live and make more. But, but they can disfigure the echinaceas a fair amount. And if you're not familiar with it, you'll wonder why this plant looks suddenly so terrible.
Yeah. Lynn sent us an email. She says, I have 5 terracotta pots on my north-facing deck. They get a fair amount of sun. They all have geraniums, white and lemon slice superbells, and supertunias. In July, there was a heavy infestation on the superbells and petunias of either aphids or whitefly that spread to all the pots. Now they're on the geraniums. The garden shop suggested I use Perithrin. Will this harm the pollinators? When things were in bloom, the bees were active.
Yeah, I didn't catch the name of what they suggested.
Perithrin, Perithrin by Bomide. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's a little heavy hitting for whitefly or aphids. You know, whitefly or aphids, you can use insecticidal soap pretty successfully. And that's what I would try first if these were my plants. I would spray with insecticidal soap and see if that takes care of the problem.
Yeah. She has a second one. She says, why are her geraniums in the bloom clusters turning black and not blooming? They're in the same location, no bugs on them. I looked at the picture she sent. I don't know if you saw that, C. Allison, but it didn't look like the leaves look healthy. It looked almost like just the flowers had died back. So maybe just deadheading the dead blooms
Well,
would be helpful.
I certainly would deadhead it. It kind of looked fungal to me, Mindy. And
Did it?
sometimes in hot and humid weather, with the emphasis on humid, we get fungal conditions, whether it's the gray mold, botrytis, or mildews, and these can sometimes turn those flowers brown before they even open up. So I would first of all clip those off and toss them out. Secondly, I would make sure that when I watered those containers, I put the hose or the watering can or whatever she's using in underneath the plant so that the flowers aren't getting wet. I'd be sure that that was the case. And I'd also look to make sure that those plants were getting as much sun now as they were in June. Sometimes we forget that at this time of year, the sun is changing position. And I know that I have places in my yard and garden that were in a fair amount of sun around the solstice in late June, and suddenly they're in, maybe two-thirds that amount of sun. And that can cause some annuals to slow down in their flower production.
All right, it's good to know. We also are seeing some mildew on things like squash, and that's really not that unusual, right, in August.
No, it's not unusual at all, particularly in a time when we have had humid weather, but not much rain. And that's because I remember reading studies from Cornell a few years ago about how rain actually washes mildew spores off the plants in the early stages. And if you have a regular hard rain, through the summertime, you tend to have much less mildew. But if you have humid weather without those hard rains, boy, that's a prescription for powdery mildew. And those plants like bee balm and phlox and the lilacs, they tend to get it. Now, what I often do is I just start to look at those plants as silver-foliaged perennials and shrubs.
I've been surprised. I have a lot of phlox, and I've been waiting for that mildew. And because almost every summer I get at least some, and so far, much to my surprise, I have not had that on the phlox. So I don't know. I don't know why, but.
Yeah, that's good. I have it on my bee balm right now. I don't have it on phlox, but I've got volcano phlox, and that's really very mildew resistant. And then I've got both David and Lavender David, also known for mildew resistance. So usually, unless it's a very, very bad mildew year, those plants come out pretty mildew free. But the other thing I tell people to do is if the mildew bothers you, just pick those flowers. When you pick a bouquet, you strip the leaves off anyway. So pick that phlox and put it in a vase, and it's gorgeous with the zinnias and the dahlias that we're starting to see come in.
Oh, I was gonna say my dahlias are doing just gangbusters. They look fantastic. They're even larger than they normally are.
They love this heat. They really do. They love the sun. They love the heat. Last year for me, very poor dahlia year. They didn't like all the regular rain that we
Right.
had. Last year was a much cooler summer, and this year the dahlias, however, are quite happy. So another upside to current weather conditions, I
There's
guess.
always ups and downs no matter what the weather brings us. We're talking with Seal
Absolutely.
Fanari. We're talking gardening this morning. If you have garden questions for us, comments, stories, suggestions, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking gardening this morning with C.L. Fanari. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Henry would like to know, what is your opinion of using sluggo on flowers and vegetables?
I think sluggo is a fine product if you have a slug problem. Sluggo is basically a bait that has iron in it, and the slugs or the snails eat the bait and they get iron poisoning and die. If they don't eat it, the iron just goes into the soil. And if something else eats that slug, it's not a problem. So I think, you know, on a limited basis, if you have a lot of slugs, that's fine. You know, it's also, in a way, faster to go out with a flashlight a couple evenings and pick them off the plants. I know it's a little gross and they're slimy, but a garden glove helps, I've found. So doing that for three or four evenings in a row can make a serious dent on the slug population.
Yeah, it's amazing, you know, how much they can eat.
Yeah, well, it is. It is. Early in the summer, I battled them on my broccoli plants, and they were doing quite a number, even before the cabbage moths hatched out and started to do their thing. So we started to control by doing that evening patrol, and that really got a handle on them.
Yeah, this guy's smart. Amy says, when can we start fall crops? Could I put in sugar snap peas, kale, or spinach now?
Yes, do it now, Amy. In fact, we just last weekend planted carrots, bok choy, broccoli. We already have kale going, so I didn't plant more of that. But certainly kale you can get going. The radishes are good. I have found sugar snap peas are a little bit dicey, but by all means, go for it and give it a try.
Yeah.
I find that they're not quite as reliable a fall crop for me as some of the other plants are.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so I have a number of daylilies. We love those beautiful daylilies, but then they finish flowering and they look a little bit ugly. What do we do about that?
Yeah, you know, this is a high maintenance perennial, frankly, because of how it looks after it finishes flowering, more than anything else. And there are a couple of methods that you can use. You can deadhead by cutting the tall empty stems off and at the same time pull off browned or streaked leaves. Or if you want to really make it fast cleanup, go in and kind of bundle up all the foliage and the stems and take a knife and just cut the whole thing off about 2 inches from the ground. And you'd completely clear it off. Now, the daylily plant comes back with new, fresh foliage very reliably. It doesn't hurt it. Then that new, fresh foliage will continue to photosynthesize and build up strength in the plant for the coming winter. But it instantly makes the garden look better. And it can also clear up some real estate in between your daylilies where you could plant some ornamental cabbages or kales or some of the fall flowering, you know, annuals.
Yeah. You know, I had a beautiful cherry tree that it didn't owe me anything. I think it was about 15 years old, but it finally just too much of it was dead that we took it down. So the hosta that I had underneath there is obviously not looking so great. And I'm thinking about planting another tree in its place, something that, you know, doesn't get much bigger than a cherry tree, you know, maybe 10, 15 feet tops. And I really love the eastern redbud, but they get so tall. I've read that there is a dwarf redbud. What do you think about them?
Well, there are dwarf varieties. There's also a variety that I have called the Rising Sun, and it's got pale leaves, and the new foliage is kind of a coral color, and then the older foliage fades to lime green, and it's quite slow growing and doesn't seem to be as large.
Oh. And is that a redbud or is that something else? Rising Sun?
Yes, no, that's a redbud.
It's a redbud.
Oh, redbud called the Rising Sun. So you might check that out.
Oh, I'll definitely check that out.
You might look for a Franklinia too. Mm-hmm. They're starting to bloom now. And, you know, having a tree that blooms from late August into October can be really interesting. That's number one. Franklinia has a very interesting story behind it. It's kind of a small multi-stemmed tree or a very large shrub. And it's really lovely and has big white camellia-like flowers. So you might look into that, Mindy. Mm-hmm. It's quite striking. I was walking the dog in Armstrong Kelly Park in Osterville the other day, and their Franklinia is in bloom. Mine is not in flower yet, but if you want to see what it looks like,
I actually did buy one a few years back, but it didn't make it.
Oh, dear. I want to mention a plant that's really made me happy this summer.
Oh, yeah.
And that is the hummingbird clethra. You know, clethra is our native summer sweet, the native variety that we find in our woodlands and, you know, on the edges of fields and all, gets probably around 5 feet tall. But hummingbird is one that only grows to about 3 feet tall. And it suckers to the side, as most clethra does. So you need to be aware of that, which is a good thing if you're, you know, planting something on a slope in part shade and want erosion control, for instance. But what really makes me happy about it is that, first of all, so many pollinators love it. When I look at that plant during the course of the day, there are probably, you know, three species of bees and several wasps and assorted other insects that I can't identify. And they are all working those flowers. And not only that, but it is stopping your tracks fragrant in the mornings and the evenings. So time I come up and down the stairs where I have this plant, you know, growing alongside the stairs, the fragrance just about, you know, it just makes me smile. That's all.
Oh, I'll have to check that out. That sounds lovely. Let's talk to Tara, who's giving us a call from West Tisbury. Hi, Tara.
Hi. So I have a question that might be kind of a dumb newbie question. I planted a quarantine vegetable garden, so I'm new to this. But my stems of my squash, they're kind of crumbling into this mush, and then there's these little round reddish, I guess they're worms or caterpillars curled up inside the stem, but they're the whole stem like mushes around them and the entire plant breaks off.
Oh dear. Okay. Well, there are a couple of borers that you can find on squash. What you should do is look at your squash carefully to see if you can see the beginnings of that happening, right? Because it is possible to slit a stem if you see the beginnings of either, you know, frass coming out of a stem or that there's, you know, that there's some sort of debris. You can tell that there has been an encroachment into that stem. It is possible to cut it open and either squish the things on the inside. I have seen people even use a Q-tip to kind of scrape them out. Or to put BT on the inside to kill the larva. That's possible. The other thing that can be done is to, when you see it starting, to dig down in the soil just beyond where the damage is and put the remainder of the stem that's still looking good into the ground and cover it with soil. Oftentimes those stems will root from that point and you can keep the plant going from then on.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great.
Yeah. And Tara, good luck.
And let me just mention a squash vine borer control that has worked very well for my husband and I. And that is when the plants are young, we dust the tops of the vines and the area right around it with wood ashes. Now, we have wood ashes because we have a wood stove, and so we save some of them every winter, and then we dust the tops of those vines. And we continue doing that probably into or through July, keeping the tops of the stems covered with a light layer of ashes and around, because the moth that lays the squash vine borer eggs doesn't like to land on that ash and crawl around through it to lay its egg underneath the stem of the plant. And so that's it's proven to be a good control for us. Now, if you're planting your squash in the same location time and again, you want to be careful because it'll raise the pH of your soil.
Yeah. So, Tara, what else? Are you happy with your vegetable garden being new to this? Have you had some successes in the garden?
I have. There's also my husband teases me. He says I've grown like a lace version of every single leaf I've planted because so much of it is eaten. And I didn't put any, it's completely organic. I didn't put anything on, and that, it turns out, means you just offer it up to all the animals eating it. But we have managed to get some stuff, but all of the cabbages, all the cabbage family are not, you know, they're all sort of delicate lace.
Yes, that's probably the cabbage moth. You know, it's a little white butterfly we see flying around in the gardens, and they lay their eggs on the kale and the broccoli and the cabbages, and then the larvae just make lace out of the foliage. And BT or spinosad are your best friends for this, and they are both organic controls. The only thing you have to be aware of in terms of spinosad, both of them are natural bacteria, but spinosad, you don't want to spray it where bees are foraging so that it's wet on bees. Other than that, it is fine for bees once it's dry. But spraying that early and as the plants are growing, you know, every week to 10 days is the key to getting good broccoli, cabbage, and kale harvest.
And when you spray those, can you then eat? How long do you wait to eat them, or you can just wash it when you harvest them?
Well, you can wash it when you harvest them, but you can eat them the next day. Both of them, as I say, are natural bacteria. Spinosad is an interesting story because it was actually discovered in a rum vat in Trinidad, and it turned out to be a bacteria that was similar to BT, Bacillus thuringiensis. And it is fine for humans to ingest. And as I say, the only issue you have to be aware of is not squirting it wet onto bees. So, and what I would also tell you to do, being a new gardener, is get a product that is a spreader sticker. Turbo is a common brand, but there may be others. And you put that in the sprayer along with your BT or your spinosad, and that makes the product stick on those cabbage and kale and broccoli leaves because you know how waxy that foliage is, and otherwise anything you spray on will just kind of run off. Yeah. And it's very effective organic control. You can eat those vegetables that night.
Great. Good advice.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tara. Good luck. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Lynn in Yarmouthport says, thanks, CL, for opening her wonderful poison ivy property during the hydrangea festival. It was such a treat to see all she and her husband created.
Yes, I call my property Poison Ivy Acres, and for two reasons. First of all, of course, we grow it well, but... Second of all, because it's kind of a Zen thing. It's a reminder that gardens and life are a whole. You know, there aren't just the pretty flowers and the tasty veggies that you want to grow. There is also the unwanted and itchy. And, you know, we have weeds and other plants that we don't want. And in order to really be have some level of general happiness, I think, in the garden and in life, you have to admit the good is part along with the bad, and you embrace it all, and because it's all part of life.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. For years, I tried to get milkweed to take in my garden, and it took me several years, and now it has just gone crazy. And I, you know, which is, and I have a whole little area where I let it kind of go crazy because, you know, we like the butterflies, but you know, we haven't seen as many monarch butterflies. We've seen a few, but not as many as we have had in years past. And I'm wondering if other people are seeing the same thing. My grandson and I have been going out and looking on the leaves, trying to find the little caterpillars. And so far we haven't found any. We've seen some of the butterflies, but no caterpillars.
Yeah, I've only seen a couple of the larvae myself, and I've got a fair amount of both the native milkweed and the Asclepias tuberosa, the other butterfly weed. And I have not seen that many larvae. I do in my garden tend to see more larvae in the late summer and fall than I do early on. But I have noticed fewer monarchs, but I've noticed more swallowtails this year.
I have too. Yeah, we've had more swallowtails this year as well, which is, I mean, they're lovely. Who doesn't want swallowtails flying around their yard? Yeah.
Yeah, well, we want them all, certainly, and we all do what we can to support them.
Yeah. Now I have a couple of apple trees. I don't do anything to my apple trees. I don't spray them. I just leave them be. And of course I have some yellowing leaves on my apple tree, and I suspect yellowing leaves are not that uncommon in lots of trees because of the drought, right?
That's right. I've got a big metasequoia tree that we looked and we saw brown branches for the first time ever. And it's been so relentlessly hot and dry. And even plants under irrigation, you know, people frequently say to me, well, I've been watering. You can't water enough in situations like this to prevent, you know, some signs of drought. That's just because the amount of irrigation we do doesn't go that deeply. And what we started out the year with great, you know, soil moisture down below, and now that's pretty much gone. So oftentimes the yellowing, particularly of the older leaves, if you see that on your plants, that's a sign of drought stress.
Yeah. So do we need to worry about any trees that are looking a little limp or yellow? I mean, should we be giving them some water as we head into fall? Watch with the, you know, how much rain we get. What should we be doing?
Well, if there aren't watering restrictions where you live, and of course that's the first thing to check.
Right.
Every town is different, and if you have watering restrictions, we need to abide by that, right?
Right.
But if
right.
there aren't watering restrictions, one of the best things you can do for a tree is to put a sprinkler at the base of that tree and let it run until you get the equivalent of an inch of rain. And so everybody should get themselves a rain gauge so that they know how much their watering is delivering. That's number one. Number two, you need to remember that a tree's roots grow beyond the edge of the drip line, beyond, you know, the edge of the foliage there. And this is why hand watering really isn't effective, because what people tend to do when they hand water is they go out and they squirt the water right at the base of the trunk or right at the base of the shrub, right? And that's not where the roots are. The roots are beyond the drip line, beyond the canopy, as well as right under the canopy. And there's just no way that hand watering can cover such a distance. And so a sprinkler helps. Put the sprinkler out, put the rain gauge out. And a rain gauge, by the way, is different from a cottage cheese carton or a tuna fish can. rain gauges measure cubic inches of water falling on square inches of soil. And right. So the opening of the rain gauge kind of determines the calibration. And a rain gauge is certainly a more accurate measurement of water than, you know, looking and seeing how much water is in the wheelbarrow or the bucket after a rainfall.
866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking gardening this morning with C.L. Fanari. Her latest book is Sand and Soil, Creating Beautiful Gardens on the Cape and Islands. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Jeff is calling from Orleans. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you? Hi, CL.
Great.
Hi, Jeff.
Well, I adore you. I love your books, and I have a quick question for you. Over the past two summers, with the way the rain has been, I've lost my lawn completely, which I'm happy having a Cape Cod lawn, but I basically now just have broadleaf weeds and dirt. And I have a grandchild, and I would like to have a 500 square foot lawn, and I'd like to know how you suggest I would get it back. Yeah. I would like my granddaughter to be able to go out and play, you know, on some grass.
Sure. Okay. And I'm assuming you have sandy soil there in Orleans?
I do, but I've, you know, every time I've reseeded over the past 10 years, I've laid down a few inches of loam, but it always seems to come back to sand.
Yeah, yeah. Well, a lot of the loam that we, frankly, purchase here on the Cape is kind of Coles to Newcastle. It's sandy itself. But I guess what I would say to you is, number one, we're coming up on the perfect time to restore lawn, okay? And what I would do if I were you is top dress with some compost before you seed, and not very much, just, you know, a light application of compost does wonders for sandy lawn. So that's number one. Number two, seeding with a mix of grass seed that's primarily fescues is a good idea. They're more drought tolerant, and they are, you know, green up earlier in the spring than the bluegrass does, for example. And there are many good mixes available on the Cape to use that are mostly fescues with some perennial rye and maybe a little bit of bluegrass in it. I would also recommend to you that you seed white clover in your lawn. You know, when I was growing up, that's what a lawn was white clover and grass.
Yep.
And the lawn care industry kind of persuaded people that white clover didn't belong in a lawn so that they could sell products to kill it. But it's nitrogen fixing, it's drought tolerant, it shades the turf grass so that your turf grass actually stays, you know, green longer, unless your grandchildren are allergic to bee stings, because the clovers do attract bees. But unless they're allergic to bee stings, you know, I think it's a great component in a lawn. And I would reseed early in the fall. And then know that, you know, there are lawns and there are lawns. And my lawn here at Poison Ivy Acres, if you look at it, it's a mix of grass primarily and clover primarily. But I've also got plantain in there. There are patches of crabgrass. There are a few other weed grasses, you know.
Sure.
And my philosophy is you mow high. You mow 3 to 4 inches tall, right? And if it's green, fine, right? If it's green and it's soft, that's what you're going for.
Yeah. Jeff, I would second what CL's saying. I also have a lot of white clover in my yard, and my grandson's allowed to pick flowers in the grass and not in the garden. And so those little white flowers, and sometimes there's some violets mixed in there in the spring. I think you can't go wrong with the white clover.
Well, what I have in the middle of my lawn is I have a patch of about 40 by 40 that has this broadleaf weed that in the winter it all just turns to dirt. And I'm not sure what it is. It grows high in the spring and has these little pods on it that seeds itself all over the place. And it's basically taken over my whole backyard. Well, a 40 by 40 area. I have a small yard.
It's probably bittercress. Does it have wire-like stems with tiny, tiny white flowers on the top?
Yes.
Yeah, that's bittercress, which is winter weed.
Yep.
And you will want to watch. I've actually seen it germinating already in parts of my area. Since you've got so many seeds of that right now, what I would just try and do is to be sure and lay both the grass seed and the clover, you know, fairly thickly down to see if you can kind of out-compete the germination of those this fall. And they are fall germinating weeds, and then they grow all winter while everything else is dormant, and then they flower in the spring. But basically, you're going to want to get your grass and your clover to be thick enough that those seeds don't germinate anymore. And that's really the key. In the future, you could, I suppose you could put a pre-emergent down if you wanted to use one in the fall, but you don't want to do that if you're starting to get the grass reestablished now.
Yeah. Right. Jeff, good luck.
One other quick thing. being that I'm looking at such a small area, and I'm not looking for a country club lawn, but are you against, it sounds like maybe you would be against sod.
Well, the only problem with sod is that it's bluegrass, and bluegrass requires more water, more fertilizer. You know, it's kind of the prima donna of turf grasses. So, other than that, there's nothing wrong with it. And frankly, you could put down sod and then next spring seed clover into the sod. You could certainly do that. And then as time goes on, when you need to refresh and reseed, you know, do that with a fescue mix, not pure bluegrass. Yeah. So,
but how would I?
You could view it as a, you know, a 2-3 year plan, and do it that way.
Yeah. Right.
Yep. Jeff, we got to run. We got several questions I got to get in. Jeff, good luck and thanks for the call. John says, over the past 2 years, I have 3 maple trees with bark that's been splitting and in some spots falling off. The trees still seem very healthy, beautiful leaves, etc. And it looks like the bark under the bare split spots are starting to fill in. What could be causing this, and are the trees going to survive?
Sometimes splitting bark can be a sign of canker disease. But you would probably, if that were the case, you'd probably see the tree not doing well over time, you know, in addition to the splitting. Sometimes splitting, he should look and see if it's on the south side of the tree. Sometimes trees split in the south side, and the damage happens during the winter because the, you know, the bark on that side kind of freezes and thaws. It gets hit by the sun, and it thaws during the day, and then it freezes at night, and that sort of process of freeze-thaw can cause barks to split. Are the trees likely to survive? I don't know. But basically, there's nothing, no intervention that we can do for splitting trees like that. And, right. You know, oftentimes trees survive against all odds. You'll see a tree that's not only split, but it's mostly hollowed out. And you can look right into the center of what, you know, used to be the trunk of the tree, and it's all hollow, and the tree is still alive.
Still going, yep.
Right? And so, you know, I remember Scott Aker, who was at the National Arboretum, once saying to me that sometimes we just need to let a tree decide if it's going to live or die. and that's hard for people because, of course, we want to do our best to help it.
Yeah. Got another tree question. Steve from Wellfleet says, we have a blue Atlas cedar that's been doing well for the last 7-8 years. And this year, the ends of several branches turned brown. And now a foot or more is brown and bare. Can it be saved?
Yeah, it's probably the drought. And again, if you can put a sprinkler under that and run it, you know, over the whole area for a while, that would be the best thing you can do. You know, we can all hope and pray for more regular rain going into the fall. As I mentioned, I have similar looking damage on my metasequoia, and it worries me. But at this point, the best thing to do is a good deep soaking if we can manage it, you know, that goes beyond the drip line. And by the way, don't think that fertilizer helps plants that are under drought stress. You know, sometimes in our desire to help, we think, oh, I'll give it some fertilizer. It doesn't need fertilizer. And in fact, that can just, you know, prompt growth that it really doesn't have the root system or the resources to, you know, sustain.
It needs rain. We need rain.
We need rain.
Yeah. Yeah. Tor is calling from Falmouth. Hi, Tor.
Good morning. Nearly first-time gardener, first in 30 years. And 2 questions, I think, that are related. 1, tomato plants. I'm amazed how big they are. Some are like 7 feet tall. I'm wondering, should I have cut them back in some way before? I mean, there are some flowers up way up at the top. Will those end up being tomatoes? And then also the zucchini. So many, you know, 20 or more fat, you know, leaf stalks down at the base. But only maybe 2 or 3 zucchini out of each plant. Again, is that what I should be expecting?
Okay. Well, in terms of the tomatoes, an indeterminate tomato, and what indeterminate means is that it's a tomato variety that continues to grow, flower, and produce fruit. And some of them can grow over time 7 to even 10, 12 feet tall in hoop houses where they grow these, you know, over the winter time, they string strings from the ceiling. And there's a reason that these are often called tomato vines, because they get so tall. And you can, if you want, you can clip them earlier. You can also just make sure that in the future you have tall supports, because yes, those flowers that are flowering way up at the top are likely to produce tomatoes as long as the growing conditions and the fall, you know, are good. So by all means, stick with it. The other thing you can do is kind of drape the long vine over the top of the structure and tie it to the top of your fencing or whatever you're using to support the plant. It's why those little tiny tomato baskets are so useless for tomato growers. And after you've grown tomatoes 1 year, you realize there's a reason that garden centers sell 6 foot tall sticks and 8 foot tall stakes that are probably more useful. We use fencing on our tomatoes, and then we tie up with strings the vines onto the top of that fencing. Now, in terms of the squash, you said that you weren't getting a number of squash, but you see a lot of blossoms. Is that right?
Decent amount of flowers, but also just the number of very thick stalks on the stems. I mean, they're 20 or 30 out of each plant. I mean, it's like an arm-sized plant coming out of the ground. And yeah, maybe two or three zucchini out of each one. I mean, is that
do you know what do you know what variety you planted?
Oh, I brought in the tomato ones, but I did not bring the envelope for the zucchini. It just said dark zucchini from the.
Oh, it just said zucchini on it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and are you growing them in full sun, Tor?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, sometimes if they have a decent amount of flowers, and look and see the flowers that are on the long, tall stems are males, and the ones that are on the short, thicker stems are females. Sometimes if you're not getting a lot of squash, it's a matter of pollination. And if you might try going out in the morning, which is when the flowers are most fertile, and sometime in the, you know, mid-morning, if you're able to do it, go out with a little soft paintbrush and have that paintbrush play B, going from the male flowers to the female flowers, and see if that increases your yield. And if it does, then you'll know that the issue is pollinators, and next year you might want to investigate planting several flowers all around that garden that will attract pollinators. Things like zinnias, for example, attract pollinators. And so that's one issue. You want to be sure, do you have more than one plant or do you just have one plant?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Probably.
You have more than one plant. Okay, well, that's good. So if you have more than one plant, that's good. The reason I asked about variety is that there are some varieties like Castata Romanesco that are known for growing great big vines and fewer amounts of squash. And the squash that that variety produces are ribbed. They're not smooth. They have sort of ridges on them. You know, the fruit itself is ridged. So that was my, I was wondering whether you might have that.
Yeah. All right. So we have to leave it there. Believe it or not, we are out of time. C.L. Funari, gardening expert. She is the author of 8 books. Her latest is Sand and Soil, Creating Beautiful Gardens on the Cape and Islands. We'll have a link to C.L.'s website at our website, capeandislands.org. Highly suggest you check her website out. C.L., thanks for sitting in for Roberta this month. Great to talk with you.
My pleasure. Have a wonderful day.
I'm Indy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.